Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 297 of the ET PhD Team podcast with myself and Georgia. Hi, Georgia. How are you?
Hello. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm very well, thank you. We're just laughing because we've just been enjoying tech problems. It's not even a full moon and tech is just not having a good time with us. Although I feel like I blame full moon, but usually it's me. I'm pleased that it's not me today.
Oh, it's definitely not you. It's definitely me. I had problems with like Spotify yesterday. And also like my Fitbit says I've done 35,000 steps today and I actually haven't left the house. So 100% it is me. It's not that much.
How on earth? What? Why has it done that? Is that like just added up over multiple days and then just not reset overnight?
I don't know. It's synced to my phone, so it should be like, you've done 5 steps. Instead, it's just like, you go, girl. I'm going for a run later as well. So I'll be like, wow, today was quite a day.
It's some sort of alert of like, maybe you're overdoing it. Although I don't know if Fitbit does that. I do feel like these activity watches should be like, oh, if you know how they remind you if you've done too little? They don't have any settings that remind you if you've done too much. Although I suppose too much is so relative. But yeah. It would be nice if there was a setting where if you were someone who was trying to improve your relationship with food in some way, you could, and like maybe you over-exercised or overdid it or struggled with rest, that you could set one up that's like, if you do it above this many number of steps in consecutive days, then be mindful. Maybe you'd like to take a rest.
Yeah, I love that. A little restorative alert. That's brilliant.
We need an ETPHD activity tracker, clearly. Although that sort of feels like it goes against some of our values, but you know. So today we're talking about menopause. This is a podcast we've been chatting about doing for ages and just haven't done it yet, which I can only really probably blame myself for. I'm gonna blame you too because I like to share the load, but realistically we've been talking about it for a while and you have so much knowledge on menopause and we don't talk about it enough. And for you, a large majority of people that you work with are predominantly perimenopausal, right? Mm-hmm. So you have so much experience in this realm. I have a lot of experience in this realm, and we're going to kind of cover the obvious things that people always ask around menopause, which are things often like fat loss, body composition. But something that people I don't think talk about enough, and that's because we don't talk about it enough, you do a good job on your social media, is the relationship with food side, the body image side, the disordered eating side that can often co-occur around this time that is, I think, exacerbated by some of the absolute bull, like perimenopausal advice.
Yeah. Do you know, I actually, if my computer had been behaving, I wanted to talk to you before we started recording, because at the weekend I went to this menopause cafe, and I just want to say that, first of all, I love the idea. I think it's amazing. And as and when I leave and move to Liverpool, I actually want to set my own up because I think the concept is incredible. And can I also just say that I 100% now see where the fear of witches comes from, because it was a women's circle talking all things like wisdom. It was incredible. And there were men walking past, peering through the window, literally looking terrified. And I was like, I feel like there's so much feminine energy. It was amazing. However, I will say this, that the person who set up the menopause cafe was just going through menopause herself and was like, I have no one to talk to. I just need friends. And so she created it, but she has no background in science or anything at all. So she gets different kind of speakers in from time to time, and she doesn't vet them. She's just like, come and talk about menopause. I bit my tongue and you'll be so proud of me, Emilia. Like, I literally had to, at one point, my jaw was clenched, my hands were in a ball between my legs, and I was just like holding it in. Like, I must have looked so unwell. But the person who was talking this weekend was a herbalist. And the things that she said, like from eliminating sugar from your diet, whether it's from fruit or from honey, you mustn't do it. You are actually, the words where you are kaput if you're putting any of that in your body, to the number of herbs and like tinctures that she was trying to sell off the back of it, and the focus on just bizarro, even like BS that I'd never heard before. I was like, oh, where is this coming from? And what really upset me about it was that the women in the room were like, they had real questions and real concerns and real worries, and these were real people, and the information advice they were being given was, you know, borderline dangerous. So at the end, I offered my services. I was like, hey, I love this concept, would love to contribute anytime in the future. And great, we have that set up and ready to go now, which is amazing. I can go in and correct everything. But I didn't want to speak up in the time and just be like, oh, do you know, this is wrong and this is wrong. I didn't want to gate crash anyone's conversation, but it took all my willpower, I will be very honest with you.
That is dark. It's scary because it's, you know, that's on a micro level, in the sense of, okay, so there may be 15 people in a room, and that's on that level. But then you see people, and I've spoken on the podcast before about, you know, a certain chiropractor, doctor in chiropractor, chiro. How do you, what are you a doctor in if you're a chiropractor?
No, because I wanted to say chiropody, but that's feet, right?
Yeah, so we're not specialists
Chiropractic?
in chiropractic. Anyway, a doctor of that, telling, you know, perimenopausal women that they must fast and they must do it in a cyclical way. And then you see other, and to millions of people. And then you see other people say, you know, sugar is the devil during perimenopause, and you will get like fat loss is much harder for you during perimenopause. And so much of the messaging is so disempowering, and not only disempowering, but incorrect, and potentially therefore dangerous, because it can impact people's relationship with food. And we'll talk about this in a little bit, but like, you like these kind of life transition times, so puberty, pregnancy, perimenopause, are key development and maintenance factors of disordered eating. And we know that, right? And this is not us saying this from our echo chamber. Everyone has disordered eating. We see a peak onset of disordered eating at these times in our lives. And if you add disordered eating, a risk of disordered eating, to misinformation, you know, food exclusion, demonizing of certain foods, stupid dietary practices, it just increases the risk even more and makes it even harder for people.
Yeah, it's just disempowering, isn't it? Because what happens is you take away the choices that people could potentially make, and you start replacing those with rules and shoulds and shouldn'ts. And like anyone who knows anything about ETPHD by now will know that every time there's a rule or a must or must never, anytime there's something that's very, very extreme, it's not going to be great for your mental well-being, and it's not going to translate well into your like physical well-being either. And that's shocking because like menopause is a third of a woman's life, so you don't want to live the third of your life just fighting, bargaining, arguing with yourself and feeling miserable. Like that's not what we need.
Third of a woman's life. I would like to say that we are going to, throughout this podcast, do our best to use inclusive language. So where possible, we will say things like people who menstruate, people go through menopause, etc. If we do mess up on our language, then I apologize. But we are like, and I don't know about you, Georgia, but like, I think as a team, we're definitely doing our very best to be mindful of inclusive language and these things. But we are also human, and we also make mistakes. So just as a sort of side note to this conversation.
Yeah, we can assume those assigned female at birth who menstruate is kind of the audience that we're talking to.
Correct. So do you want to give a brief overview of, like, I think some people don't necessarily know what menopause is. I'm sure a lot of people who are perimenopausal or have been through menopause know, but can you give a little bit of an overview for people,
I
please?
will. And do you know what? I need to do a post on this because actually, so many people have dropped me a message and said, I don't know the difference between menopause, perimenopause, like, etc. And a part of me had just assumed that it was comfortable kind of common knowledge, but it's not. So it is great to take a second here, and it's a good reminder for me to clarify as well. But you've like these three stages that we're really kind of talking about. So menopause itself is defined as the cessation of menstrual cycle, and it's identified as the point in time that is exactly like 12 months to the day after a final period. So technically, this definition applies to one day of your life, and that it is it. And then preceding that, we've got the transition period before, which is known as perimenopause, which is kind of banded around. And also, you might hear it as defined as like the menopause transition. And this is when ovaries are producing less estrogen, or intermittently kind of fluctuating levels, but you are still menstruating. So you might menstruate after 11 months break and not quite be in menopause yet. And then we have the menopause period, or the postmenopause period, which is 12 months after your last period plus one day, and then for the rest of your life. And yeah, this is, on average, a third of someone's life. So that's kind of a nutshell.
I think what's great about that description too is people think menopause, they think no estrogen, and it's this immediate kind of thing, and it's not. And we do see fluctuations in estrogen, and there are some phases during perimenopause where you may even be estrogen dominant, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit too. But I think that's a lot of the advice from people who kind of understand like the basics of menopause are kind of like, okay, well, your estrogen just bottoms out, and then training becomes harder, and then all of these things happen. And perimenopause is not like a 6 month period. It's like it can go on for a while, and estrogen can fluctuate throughout this time. Oh, your reproductive hormones can fluctuate throughout this time.
Yeah, and it can take years, and that's not to be pessimistic and say, oh my God, this transition's going to take so long. But for some people, and for some of my clients even, perimenopause has begun in early to mid 30s, and it's taken 15, 20 years to fully transition through to that postmenopausal period. And it's kind of like, if you think back to puberty wasn't just like something that you did in a week or a day. There were all kinds of symptoms and signs, from like my skin doing whatever it chose to do, mood swings, etc., to finally kind of starting a period. And even then, periods weren't consistently regular for a certain amount of months. I can't even remember now. It's a transition period. So we kind of want to think about menopause as a similar kind of transition, which is why I kind of like the phrase menopause transition rather than perimenopause, because it does describe it as a phase of life that you're kind of moving through.
And it's perimenopause doesn't have to have negative connotations. It definitely, I think, sometimes can, just because of the stupid messaging sometimes. But menopause transition feels a lot more like a journey, and can be framed in a much more, I feel like, helpful and healthful light. If just even hearing it, hearing the words, I think for me that would probably be how I would phrase it if I was like, when that time comes for me. I think that feels nicer in my body when I use that term. And these little things all are helpful for us. Okay, so we're not going to be giving out medical advice in this pod by any means, and we might touch on HRT, but we're looking at realistically nutrition, body comp, training, body image, etc. That is, and we want you to kind of come off this podcast feeling like, yeah, do you know what? I know what I need to do. I know where my triggers potentially are for my relationship with food, for my body image, and I know where I can do work on these things and not feel susceptible to the misinformation, like the manifestation phase of fasting, which was one of the things that I heard about. I think it's during your luteal phase, or I think it's during your luteal phase of your period. This person who tells perimenopausal women to fast also says that people who have a regular menstrual cycle should be doing a manifestation fasting phase during their luteal phase, which sounds like it's right on my street, aside from the fasting part.
Just saw on the camera, my face was doing this thing where I'm like, sucking my lips in, and this is definitely what I was doing at the weekend, because the other thing she'd said was, if you're not, it was so matter of fact as well, if you're not detoxing your liver at least twice a year, like, you're gonna die. I was just like, she's like, it's just gonna build up all the estrogen and that's it, you are done. And I was like, oh, I'm sweating from holding this in. Oh my God.
And also, we're all still alive. So great for us without detoxing our livers. Like, oh my God,
Yeah.
wild.
Yeah. Like,
Okay,
living
so
proof here.
I think that at what are the main, what's the main kind of things that when you speak to clients that they initially start to work with you, what are their main focuses? What are their main goals? And let's kind of unpack it that way.
I think the kind of the main things that come through are wanting to feel like their body is their own again, because there are changes that are happening physically, but also things like mood swings, irritability, not feeling like themselves, and noticing that there's a lot of reactivity and emotional eating and comfort eating as a result of that. So those would be kind of be the main things that come through. And then in terms of body image, a lot of the time this redistribution of where body fat is to around the middle, which typically in younger years, we are kind of conditioned to have this flat stomach and really quite girlish kind of figure. And that doesn't translate with the changes in hormones and the way that our body changes as we progress into the menopause transition. And that can feel very uncomfortable and very triggering for people that have spent a lot of time really focused on controlling their bodies as well. So those would be the two main things that come through for clients.
Yeah, and I think the these two are inextricably linked. You know, there's a reason that at ETPHD we have pillars around food, nutrition, and body image. We do see associations with, you know, less positive body image and increased risk of disordered eating. And so it's very difficult to tackle one without the other, and not particularly helpful. And if you experience maybe a lot of emotional eating, say, it's likely that you may well experience poor body satisfaction, as an example, although definitely not a given. But what I think is interesting is the research around people who have like positive beliefs about menopause, and they are likely to see, there's some research that looked at like positive that body image at this time, and people who had more positive beliefs about menopause were more likely to experience a more positive body image, and potentially lower depressive symptoms, which I think is really, really interesting. So all of the work that we do is about empowering you to feel more positive about these things, as opposed to like, this is it, your life is going to completely change, you're never going to be able to work on your body composition again, and you're going to be completely out of control of your body, because you're not out of control of your body. And I think one of the drivers of disordered eating at this point is the fear that you're losing control of your body, or the fear that everything is going to change, and just the societal pressure of going through menopause and the pressure put on women as we age as a whole. There was some recent research last year, I want to say it was last year, that said that it was specifically like this fear of gaining weight and fear of losing control over eating habits that was central to dysfunctional eating during perimenopause. So I would love if people who are going through this can think about like, do I have this fear of gaining weight? Do I have a fear of losing control? And if that's the case, things like fasting, I understand the pull towards them, because you think, okay, well, fasting is going to help me maintain my calorie intake. And it's also very rigid sense of control that you are creating. It's another way of really controlling your diet. You can control your diet often as a way to give you a sense of control when you feel like you're losing it elsewhere.
I think it loss of control or feeling like their body is working against them are definitely kind of phrases that come up quite frequently. It's that loss of connection to self and feeling that if we're in a fixed mindset, well, this is how it is, it's all downhill from here. If this happens, then the prediction of, well, X, Y, and Z will also happen. And again, it comes back to that feeling quite disempowered around choices and what's happening versus do with sort of psychological and therapeutic tools to be working on that growth mindset of I have agency and I have power over kind of my choices.
Yeah. And I think this is a nice time to kind of look at the body composition side of things, of a lot of this fear of gaining weight, a lot of this fear of losing control of your body or being disconnected, is driven in some part because of the society we live in by body fat gain or body composition changes. And I think the most important thing that we want to kind of talk about here is like fat loss is not impossible, muscle gain is not impossible. You don't suddenly just, the laws of thermodynamics don't just suddenly stop working for you, or become, appropriate. And also your basal metabolic rate is not crashing. Like it's not, we see very slight reductions in BMR as we age, but they're not significant. Like we know that changes in body composition in general as we age for any or for all genders is more related to the habits that we have. It's just that, like you touched on earlier, with perimenopause, fat loss can be harder because of some of the requirements of fat loss. And on top of that, this shift in like body fat redistribution that we get towards the midsection, which makes it feel like you're not making progress sometimes because you constantly look at your midsection. And you feel like, well, I'm not getting any leaner, but you could still be losing body fat, but you're not getting any leaner. But it then all just falls into this self-fulfilling prophecy of it's just impossible to lose fat at this time.
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the most upsetting kind of, let's say, like menopause tropes that I hear quite a lot, which is like your metabolism breaks in menopause, and therefore if you're not dieting on 800 or 1200 calories, you're never going to lose weight. And when we're thinking about what you said around body composition there, is that if somebody is then focusing very much on calorie intake, what tends to go out the window quite early on is nutritional density of meals, and protein intake can drop greatly, and we can't build a healthful skeleton or like muscle, lean muscle mass for the rest of our life, which we require to live and reduce our risk of things like heart disease. But equally, we can't have the like quote unquote like toned look that typically women are kind of chasing if the nutrition is not there to support that as well. And you also can't have the energy to train and to lift and to do the things that will support that body composition. So a lot of the time people will think, well, maybe, my metabolism is broken and or maybe I'm not eating enough to kind of get the results that I want. We hear that quite a lot. You're not losing weight because you're not eating enough calories. But what we're actually seeing is a reduction in muscle mass and either the same body fat or a slight increase in body fat, because that's not a realistic diet to stick to. And we see overeating and emotional eating increase. So really extreme diets, like you said, fasting and cutting things out, actually just sets people up for a much tougher time of achieving what they're looking to achieve.
Such good points. And kind of on that too, we do see a blunted anabolic response as we age, all genders. And because of the shifts in hormones during perimenopause and postmenopause, muscle building is more difficult. So if you took a 70-year-old person and a 20-year-old person and you gave them both a chicken breast, the response to that chicken breast, the anabolic response, i.e. the kind of like the muscle building, the growth response to that chicken breast, in the 70-year-old would be lower than it would be in the 20-year-old. What also often happens, like you said, is people become more restrictive or they reduce their calorie intake, their protein intake drops, or food preferences potentially change. And so protein intake often will drop. And so, like you said, you can see these shifts in body composition, and people think, oh, it's because of my metabolism. But actually, is it not because you're exhausted when you're going into training? Because things like sleep quality might be impacted through perimenopause, plus the fact that you're not eating sufficiently to give yourself energy, plus the fact then you're not eating sufficient protein to support that resistance training session consistently. And, kind of on that, like it can be more difficult because of things like I said, sleep quality and mood changes, and the energy and hunger regulation. If you have poor sleep, you're more likely to have higher levels of certain hunger hormones. So you're more likely to be hungrier. So there are things that make it more difficult for sure, but these are all things that you can support yourself with. So You've mentioned a couple of times, I think both of us have kind of mentioned a couple of times around disordered eating, and this kind of being a key transition point. And we know that, I'll kind of let you delve into this. You did a great post on this yesterday. But something I've mentioned probably on the on a pre and postnatal podcast, on an PMS podcast, is that we do see disordered eating symptoms, especially things like emotional eating and binge eating, kind of fluctuate in association with changes in estrogen. So more so when estrogen and progesterone are high, we tend to see peaks in emotional eating and binge eating. So this happens, for example, during the luteal phase. And it can also happen at states of through perimenopause, where we do have those smaller time periods where estrogen, we are estrogen dominant. And so we can get these shifts. And I'm not saying that estrogen is to blame, and I know you've got some stuff to talk about on this, but I think that sometimes there's like this element for people, you know, who feel like, well, at my age, you know, grand old age of 45, I should have all of these things under control by now. And it's like, we've worked with, you know, thousands of people from, yes, from their 20s up until, I'd say, I don't know if we've had anyone in their 70s yet, but in their 60s who are working on the relationship with food. And I have so much respect for that, because it's like, it's more difficult when you've had these things ingrained in you for so long. And I think there's an element when, if some of these things kind of rear up during perimenopause, where that's understandable why, but then there's also the element of like, people are so pissed off with themselves because they're like, well, why don't I have it sorted? Why don't I have the willpower yet? Or why haven't I figured this out yet? And it's like, lots of people, like, these transition times are key, quote unquote, trigger points.
One thing I would say on that, that just came to mind as you were talking through like the ages of people that I've worked with, I would say some of my older clients that are in their 60s have reached a point where there's less resistance to working on their relationship with food, because yes, there is a sense of, oh, I should have this sorted by now, but there's also a, I'm damned if I continue without sorting this out. And there's always some resistance when it comes to behavior change and kind of focusing on our mindset. But some of these people that I have worked with have been like, yeah, I see resistance and I'm pushing through because I want this, this, and this for the rest of my life. And I want to take my kids and my grandkids out and get ice cream and enjoy it and also still be healthful. And that's been probably some of the most rewarding work that I think I've done, because I know that they have had this for potentially 40, 50 years of their life, and it is never too late. Like, they come to me with this attitude of like, oh, I don't know if it is too late for me, is it okay to start this now? And I think it's really empowering to know that, like, again, I'm not an expert on brains at all, but when we're talking about things like neuroplasticity, that it's never too late to learn something new and to unlearn something that has been there for a long time. So yeah, it's never too late to do the work.
Yeah. And then what was the post that you put up yesterday around, you spoke about like the hormonal impact on, I think it's specifically mood and that link to emotional eating.
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of, I guess I'll give an overview, but when we're thinking about things like estrogen, when our estrogen levels are lower, this can result in increased hunger and decreased feelings of fullness as well. So our estrogen and progesterone can have direct impacts on our hunger hormones. So it can be harder to feel that we have control, quote unquote, over food intake. And progesterone has a little bit of an impact on appetite regulation as well as like cravings as well. But when we're thinking about the impact that they also have on our neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine, that we can be more susceptible to things like mood swings, irritability, and actually feeling that we need more comfort and soothing and control that comes from food as well. So it makes a lot of sense that when we're transitioning through this period where we're on an emotional roller coaster, and I will say for some of my clients, it can be, you know, one day completely fine, feeling great in their body, and the next day really feeling like, you know, rage, meno rage, irritability, can't sleep, ravenous hunger, that they turn to food because it gives them the mental comfort that they need. And there's also the physical drivers in terms of like the reduced fullness, increased hunger as well. And those cravings are very, very real.
Yeah, and I think we know from, that foods that are high in, for example, salt, fat, sugar, they're more likely to, they trigger a certain neurotransmitter response that does bring us that temporary satisfaction, that temporary joy. And then the more that we consume these, that we get these dopamine-enforced sensory cues, so the more we want them again. So when you're struggling maybe emotionally at this time, it's completely understandable that you go towards foods that are high in these potential nutrients because they provide that for us. And so it's not like, again, it's not like you've suddenly lost willpower, but we know that things like mindfulness, for example, reduces when you've had poor sleep and then you have the hunger on top of that and reductions in satiety. So it can be tough. And so in terms of nutrition, things like making sure that your diet is like you're eating regularly, that you have sufficient protein, maybe slightly higher protein because of this blunted anabolic response, that you have a diet that's rich in fiber, fruit and vegetables to support your satiety levels, really, really important, and not being super, super restrictive because of these potential things that might lead you then to overeat.
And also remembering that you still need carbohydrates, and again, just everything we say is just bring me flashbacks to things that have wound me up. But you're not suddenly allergic to carbohydrates because your hormones are changing. You still need them. They're our preferred body's energy source. So not only does your brain need it, so it's going to really help to reduce things like brain fog and give you clarity and energy to get through the day. But also, when we're thinking about training to the intensity where we can get muscle gain results, yes, we need the protein. It supports the recovery and the muscle mass, but we also need the carbohydrates that give us the energy to go and train intensely. Like, there's a huge difference between if you're training fasted versus you've had a great meal where you've had some carbohydrates and you're like unstoppable Hulk in the gym. And then on top of that, we've also got the roles of unsaturated fats that are there. Again, it helps with satiety and enjoyment because it just tastes so good. A little bit of fat goes a long way to making something feel awesome. But also, when we're thinking about long-term health as well, and I know we're sticking to relationship with food, but when we're thinking about things like future health and heart disease, like unsaturated fats are essential, particularly with heart disease being one of the like the leading killers of women in menopause. So eating more fats can be really, really protective. So these things that perhaps we've cut out in the past because we think, oh, high calorie, I'm focusing on numbers, this is an easy, quick way to reduce my intake, actually could be super beneficial for you. Well, is are super beneficial for you. No,
Absolutely.
maybe.
I love that. And it's also that it also ties into like that ETPHD ethos of having an inclusive approach to your nutrition rather than a restrictive approach. We know that having an inclusive approach is associated with the like re reduced likelihood of disordered eating or reduced risk of disordered eating. So if you're struck someone who struggles with binge eating or emotional eating at this time or restriction overeating cycle, moving away from that restrictive mentality and towards like this inclusive mentality. And I think like a Mediterranean style dietary pattern here is a really lovely kind of framing. And when we're looking at diets, we are looking at dietary patterns. It's not just like specific foods, but a dietary pattern that mimics that is a really healthful, I'm not saying it has to be that, but like a really healthful approach. And often Mediterranean style diets are potentially high in foods and things like phytoestrogens, flavonoids, etc., which can be really beneficial for our health too.
Yeah, and I think one of the most exciting things I see with clients is when they start to say, "Oh, I've been really thinking this week about like what can I include in my meals? Like how many colors can I get in, or how many flavors, herbs, spices can I taste in my food?" Rather than what like quote unquote should I be taking away? Like what should I or shouldn't I be eating? It's like, "Oh, how can I make this even more nourishing?" And it becomes a focus on joy and enjoyment, which we know improves satisfaction from food in general, which helps to reduce cravings. But also, people are then thinking about making meals as fulfilling as possible so that they're actually supporting this increase in appetite that we see, and increasing their energy levels so that they can train or they can go and be active and they can focus on what they want to focus on at work because they're not starving and having a rumbling stomach and focused on calorie counting.
Totally. That was the least intellectual response to any interesting thing that anyone's ever said. I'm like, totally. Can't believe that.
Sometimes I'm just like,
And then in terms of training, so what I tend to see with people often at this point is people often will either double down and try and train more and train harder because they feel, again, it's a sense of control, or they fear potential body composition changes, or the other side of things of like, well, I've never really weight trained before. I don't really know what I'm doing. What's the point now? And they kind of back out of it completely. And like, is there an overall training kind of pattern that you use in terms of like resistance training, cardio, HIIT, yoga, anything like that? Like, is there, obviously it's not a one size fits all, but what kind of things do you recommend?
Yeah, that's such a good question. No, you're quite right. Like it very much depends on someone's training experience and also their lifestyle as well, so that we're fitting it in a way that doesn't exhaust them. But typically, sort of resistance training 2 to 3 times a week tends to be very manageable. It doesn't have to be for an hour or 2 hours at a time. It really is, can we get in, have an effective workout in half an hour and 40 minutes? And training sort of full body will really help to reduce the stress and strain on kind of like joints, ligaments, tendons, and things as well, and help with really good recovery. So we try and spread that out throughout the week. And then including things like yoga, like yes, for mindfulness, but also like connection to body, for supporting mobility in the joints, and having something that is nourishing and restorative movement that isn't high intensity, unless you're doing like power yoga, can be great as well. But really important within that time to consider cardio. And that's not for, again, body composition goals, although it will contribute a small amount towards energy expenditure. But again, the inner personal trainer and nutritionist to me is coming back to not just in the moment, but long-term health for the rest of your life. We need to have cardiovascular capacity, and that only comes with some cardio training. So you don't need to take up marathon running. You don't have to go to a spin class, but having something during your week that, nice guidelines, you're kind of looking at about 150 minutes of like steady state cardio and popping in a couple of high intensity sessions in. You don't have to be in the gym for hours on end. That could look like at the end of one of your full body workouts, just doing 10 minutes of higher intensity cardio. And it might look like when you go for your regular walk with the dog, just having 10 minutes, 20 minutes, where actually there's a very slow and comfortable jog within that as well. So I really take into account what my clients' preferences are, what their experience is, and what kind of time they have, but there are lots of ways to sort of mix and match so that it's a really effective workout. And knowing that there are no have-tos or shoulds, like if you don't want to do a barbell back squat, that is fine. There are lots of variations that you can use in the gym, whether it's using equipment or using body weight, where you can still stimulate like muscle growth.
Yeah. And I'll just kind of to add on to that, if you're someone who's trained 5 times a week for the last 10 years, you're like, I don't want to, why would I only train 2 to 3 times a week? You wouldn't. Like, we're not saying reduce your training because you're perimenopausal at all, like that at all. But it's a nice time to look at, what does my overall training look like? Does it look like I'm hammered from 5 training sessions a week in the gym, resistance training, that I don't do any cardiovascular work, and I definitely don't make time for yoga? Because that's not hard enough, then this is a good time to look at that. But if you're like, oh, I train 4 to 5 times a week, I do a HIIT session a couple of times a week after training, and I do yoga once a week, fantastic. You're not weaker. You're not, there's not like, this is not a time where it's like, oh, you need to really take it easy on yourself. Like, no, it's a time for compassion of things might feel more challenging, and especially with training, you might feel like discomfort with certain lifts, for example. And a concept I quite like is like the traffic light system, or having like a selection box of exercises where it's like, okay, so you have back squat, leg press, split squat, and like maybe like even leg extension, right? And you have this box of like, okay, if back squat to me feels really uncomfortable, then I'm going to do leg press instead or something like that. So having this kind of selection box of exercises that you can use, I think is a really, really good concept. But again, it's not because you're weaker or because you need to strip things back. It's more just because sometimes you might have, for example, vaginal dryness, which makes certain things uncomfortable. And so it's just about giving yourself the option to do different things and being okay with doing that.
I like that flexibility. And again, it's moving away from the all or nothing towards the all or something. So if there's a day that's kind of following on from a night of really poor sleep, and you think my energy levels are very, very low, but I know that movement makes me feel good, you know that you have this permission from yourself. You don't have to go to the gym and like push the intensity, but you might go and say, okay, well, actually, I'll go with like these movements that I'm still doing something, it's still positive, I'm still getting benefits from it. And yet I'm also managing what my energy feels like today and my ability to recover and cope with tomorrow, rather than kind of flooring myself and then tomorrow feeling like, oh goodness, I'm dragging myself through again. So love that approach.
Yeah. Last thing you want to be doing is having like 2 weeks worth of absolutely woeful sleep and hammering yourself and not giving yourself that variety. And I think finally, just to finish up in terms of supplements, because again, it's a prime time for people to be selling you shit. And you know, at ETPHD, we kind of usually have some fundamental supplements that for most people, not all people, we would recommend in terms of omega-3 if you're not having 3 servings of oily fish a week, vitamin D, especially in the UK between the months of October and April, but ideally probably year round. And then there are certain things with perimenopause, for example, bone mineral density becomes really, really important. I mean, it's important anyway. It's one of the reasons why exercise is so important, but supporting that with calcium alongside your vitamin D, really, really helpful. Creatine, really potentially beneficial in terms of muscle mass, power, strength, potentially cognitive decline. And as we age, we see natural reductions in like creatine levels in our body, creatine kinase levels in our body. So we want to supplement with that. And another one I sometimes recommend is magnesium, just because we see often a decline in magnesium alongside reductions in estrogen. Is there anything else on that you would recommend or consider for certain people?
Not really. I was gonna say, even my mum takes creatine, and I've enforced, it sounds quite forceful, but I've made sure she's done that for a long time because she's also vegetarian as well, so she just doesn't get any naturally in her diet. So and do have like cognitive decline diseases in our family as well, so I've made sure that she's taking that. But I think that pretty much covers everything that I would look for. Yeah.
Okay, fab. So if unless there's anything else you want to add, I think from my end wrapping up, it's just to say, like, whatever you're experiencing, there's nothing, it's not a willpower problem, it's not a self-control problem, it's not a broken problem, it's not a should have fixed earlier problem, it's not taking it too easy on yourself problem, it's not being too hard, but might be being too hard on yourself problem. And to be fair, it might actually also be that you're taking it too easy on yourself too. There's compassion is so important here. But there's two sides of that. There's the kind, soft, caring side of compassion, and there's the fierce, what will my tomorrow self thank me for side of self-compassion. When we are coaching in a compassionate way, it's both. Sometimes we're quite hard and we're like, this is what you want to achieve and this is what we need to do. And sometimes we're usually a bit of both, because it's the yin and yang, right? But reframing things and setting yourself up, trying to foster more positive age beliefs can be really, really supportive, especially when it comes to things like body image and disordered eating at this time.
Well, do you know, one last supplement I would suggest would be including something like Agnus Castus or Vitex. Just we didn't really touch on HRT, but if you do take HRT, like, it's good just to check in with your doctor because it can interact with that. But it can be excellent for managing kind of mood swings around your cycle, because I think something I just want to be really clear on is that when you are going through the menopause transition and you're perimenopausal, you still have a cycle. It just fluctuates and it's much less predictable than in earlier years. So your cycle might be much longer or it might be much shorter, but that can be a great supplement to add in.
Agree. I think when I've recommended people who are perimenopausal with this before, their doctors have usually advised, if they're on HRT, I've always said this is a potential, but not until you've got the okay from your doctor. And doctors have generally said don't take it if you're taking HRT. So yeah, big disclaimer there of like, if you are considering HRT or are on HRT, then would avoid unless you've spoken to your doctor and they're like, oh yeah, great idea. Okay, fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you ever have any questions on menopause, feel free to message me, message Georgia, Georgia's got tons of really great menopause content on her Instagram page, which is of course linked in the show notes, so you can go and see them. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.